Welcome to the Spotlight Edition of the Future of Medicine podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Wright. Join me as I have conversations with fascinating medical experts as we discuss a variety of compelling topics. We aim to not only inform you, but to empower you, instilling confidence along your journey toward optimal health. This podcast is brought to you by Brentwood MD. Located just south of Nashville, Tennessee, Brentwood MD provides best-in-class concierge primary care. To learn more about our innovative approach to primary care, visit our website at brentwoodmd.com. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Natalie Spradlin, an assistant professor of hematology and oncology at Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center. She has over 14 years of clinical experience. A Nashville native and a graduate of Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, she currently holds three board certifications: internal medicine, hematology, and oncology. She is deeply involved in physician development, currently holding the position of co-director at Vanderbilt's Internal Medicine Miller Society. She's a dedicated educator, regularly teaching medical students, residents, and fellows in clinic. In fact, for the 2024 academic year, she was given the Outstanding Clinic Home Preceptor Award. Her passion for education shows up today in how she communicates and educates her current patients. We hope you enjoy our conversation. Dr. Spradlin, I'm so excited to have you join me today. Really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy clinic to come and chat about these topics. And as we kind of continue to introduce you to our audience, tell me a little bit about your background and what led you specifically into the field of oncology as a medical profession.
It's a calling for me. I was going to stay far, far away from cancer patients because my grandmother had breast cancer at a pretty young age. And so I grew up very afraid of cancer. And so I was going through my training and thought that I would probably ultimately settle on primary care. And so I decided if I was going to do primary care, I needed to shore up some areas that I was deficient in. And that included ophthalmology, so the eye. And so I did a rotation a month in the eye and then ophthalmology. And then I decided I had avoided cancer my whole residency. And so I decided I would do an outpatient rotation on oncology. And
wow,
I was caught within 2 weeks. It was just such a honor and a privilege to get to go in. It's a true need, obviously. You go in and you can come up with a plan when I always felt like, you know, oh, you have cancer. We're going to, so sorry. And back and people back away. And I wanted to go in there and say, let's roll our sleeves up and figure out what we can do.
Yeah.
And it was just a true, privilege, honor. I got to use my brain. I always say I can't bake people a meal or anything like that, but I can help figure out a plan and I can study hard and work hard and figure out how we're going to make things better to the best of our ability.
Yeah.
So it just caught me. So it's a mission for me. I enjoy it. And then there's a ton of education in hematology, oncology. And so I enjoy educating the people that come into my office. And my goal is when they leave that they can speak about what's going on with them.
Yeah,
and that they understand, because this isn't rocket science. There's a lot of information behind the decisions and the conclusions, but anybody's capable of being able to understand and kind of move forward. So there's a lot of education.
When I'm so glad to know that part of your story. Mm-hmm. As you and I do know each other personally, I had no idea that it was that decision of like, hey, I need to experience this that ended up changing your life.
Absolutely.
And, you know, as you say that, I really feel like probably that calling is so important for you and how you communicate with patients. Because I was just thinking, as you said that, you don't see anything that is worry-free. You know, you don't often probably get to see people and say, you know, this is completely fine. Don't worry about it. You're often the one sharing some really difficult and uncertain news, which, as you and I were just talking about, this is what we're going to build this episode around, is kind of walking a patient or a family member through that process of uncertainty and fear, maybe denial, from their perspective, but through the tenderness of a provider who cares. I was just thinking too that the bedside manner is probably no more important than in an oncology office, where you don't know what, especially as you meet somebody new, what kind of emotions they're bringing in.
Sure.
And so to have that sense of meeting people where they are and then directing them ultimately toward, hey, here's the plan. So beautiful. So let's actually start there by thinking through
you know, situations that many of our listeners, you know, might just fear these conversations like you did. You kind of wanted to stay away from oncology. Many might even be staying away from this podcast because they don't even want to know what could come. Let's walk through when they get that first call. You know, I'm often in the position in primary care where I'm giving them the call that says, hey, we have something. You know, we don't have a tissue diagnosis that I can tell them it's cancer for sure. So I live with them in the gray zone. But then you're often the one who meets them in that gray zone and they're worried for worst case scenario. So, you know, let's talk through how when someone hears the news, hey, this could be cancer. What are some of the things that you want them to initially anchor themselves to as they go through that process?
Some advice, some caution would be one thing people come in and they, oh, my friend told me this and my neighbor told me this. And when they share the news broadly, it's important to share those burdens and those, you know, if a person especially is extroverted, to share what's going on. But the unintended consequence of that is you will get 30 opinions on what you need to do next. And my so-and-so saw so-and-so and they're the best and no, this one's the best. And it creates a lot of angst that, oh, but I've got to see the best. And obviously everybody wants the best. What I tell, at least in the region that we're in, you're in a resource-rich area of the world. There's a lot of good out there. There's a lot of good providers out there. So so just kind of bringing it back is just be aware that everybody's going to try to tell you either their miracle story or their horror story. And you have to see my best friend, aunt's doctor. And, you know, and so it can become overwhelming and create a lot of uncertainty in the midst of a very uncertain situation. So I would just caution who they tell and what they tell on the before they can get in with an oncologist and hear some facts and some truths before they then decide to share. If they share it ahead of time, so be it. But human nature is they're going to want to come and tell you their stories and tell you about their miracles, or their some people will tell their horror stories. And it's just, it just becomes more than the person bargained for. So who you tell and who you listen to in those early days while you wait for your appointment is important. Just for kind of your mental space. And then I would caution people about getting on chat rooms, just like Facebook chat groups or things that are non-academic, because there's a lot of anecdotes, which apply only to the person which the anecdote occurred, but it's not—it's not the statistics or the bigger picture. And so people can get too afraid or too, you find what you're looking for. And so there's, I would just caution about getting into chat rooms and Googling a lot before the person gets in and actually gets some facts from their doc.
No, that's great insight too. And I would think, I have no stats to back this up, but probably there is no field more studied than oncology where you've got the stats, you know, the success rates, you know those details. So when you go searching and you get the anecdotes, it can be really overwhelming because you may have heard the outlier story. And it might not be applicable to them. That's really good advice. Is that one of the more common kind of challenges that when you meet someone, you kind of have to deconstruct and work through?
Yes, absolutely. Deconstruct's a great word. So my approach is you start with the facts. You verify the history. So, you know, this is what I've read. Is this the way it went? Is this how this spot became known or whatever? And then you have to go through the data and the fact, this is what we know. This is the size. This is where it's located. This is what it could be. And then this is how we need to work it up and approach it. So it's a very systematic approach.
Well, you kind of reference caution around chat rooms and the internet. Is there any way that you feel like that's going to be a natural tendency? Somebody's going to want to go either to someone or something and get information. Is there any productive way to use and steer that desire before they see you?
I think before you get on the internet and you go to Dr. Google or whatever, figure out what your questions are. Write those down. What answers are you searching for? Because whatever you input in a Google search bar, in a social media platform, it may or may not be applicable to you in great detail. So figure out what your questions are. Write those down so that you have a clarity of focus when you're at that appointment. And it's part of, in my opinion, your doctor's responsibility to help identify, you know, some truths that you can go home with, whether even if it, we don't know what this is yet, but here are some facts for you to hold on to, you know? And so, but you need to know what you're searching for. And then ask whether or not you think you can get that answer from a Google search. And if the answer is no, because a lot of times what people are searching for is it curable? Am I going to die? You know, how's it treated? Cancer is not all the same. And so the treatment plan depends on what exact type it is, what stage it is, the health of the person. And so what you go and you read and you assign to yourself before you ever get into the office for the first visit may not even apply to you.
So. And I feel like, and you reference kind of that burden that that can be for a patient who is appropriately anxious, appropriately worried, but then to kind of hunt down information that could be truly a waste of that mental energy if it doesn't end up applying to them. And you know, I think it is important for us to just kind of name that and say, hey, that's a tendency. It's a reasonable tendency. And you may actually get to a point where you have enough information to then go search for more, but not initially. Because chances are, if you don't know what questions you want answers to, the internet may give you worst case scenarios or things that don't apply to you. So that's a really good reminder. I love that. Figure out your questions. And that may be the starting point. Spend the energy there. And then bring those questions into a visit with the oncologist.
Because as you said, and I talk about it with my people, that could be wasted energy. You can be putting that energy towards good use somewhere else rather than spinning. I will say it where I practice, we try to get new cancer diagnosis patients in within 10 business days. So now that 10 business days could mean 2 weeks on the calendar, right? And so, I mean, I acknowledge that, you know, if I was diagnosed with a mass, I want my visit to have occurred 2 days before, you know? So while that's a long time to wait, we do, there is a concerted effort to try to get people in intentionally quickly. And so just know that that is happening behind the scenes. The other thing I will say is before the visit, if you feel like whatever's going on with you, if you feel like the visit you're given by an access center is inappropriately far out, it's okay to advocate for yourself and do a follow-up phone call to either the doc referring you or to the center and say, I was found to have such and such, but I was given a visit such and such. Is this appropriate? And ask that question. That's okay. You know, because the provider at the other end of that visit has no idea how long you've been waiting for that visit until they walk in, that that day comes and they see you. They don't know that you're on their schedule per se. Does that make sense?
It does. Absolutely. Well, and I'm thinking of ways we can encourage individuals to kind of steer that energy and that desire into productive ways. And I love your first one, the figure out the questions. Maybe another one would be as they prepare for that first visit with you, how can they prepare maybe a summary of their history or some of their details so that then when they walk into your office, you as the provider are a little more empowered. And that allows them to kind of focus on something they can be doing during the waiting. So as somebody prepares for a visit with you, what are things that you really like patients to bring to you the first time they see you?
So if they don't bring anything, that's okay. Where I work, we have a records acquisition department. So a lot of the records I've got access to. And like for me, not every doc, but for me, I review all of that before I ever walk in the room. So I rarely am going, I'm almost never going into a room cold. Now, not every doc's going to be the same way. What's helpful for the person to know is family history of cancers. Who had what? How old were they? And it's usually a ballpark is fine. So if you say, oh, my mom's sister, so a maternal aunt, had breast cancer. About how old was she? Was she 20? was she 90? You know, that's a big difference in terms. What we're getting at is, do I sense that this person might have a strong family history of cancers? Does it cluster in groups to suggest such and such predisposition syndrome? Because there are some genetic cancer syndromes, like the most common one that people hear about, famous actress like Angelina Jolie and people like that, the BRCA, BRCA, BRCA 1 and 2, those are cancer syndromes. And so those people that have that gene mutation, they're born with it. It's nothing that they develop as they age. They're born with the BRCA gene mutation. They're at a very high risk to get a breast cancer earlier in life, uterine cancer, ovary cancer, skin cancers. There's this cluster of cancers that go with BRCA. So when you're preparing to go visit with a cancer specialist, it'd be important to know your family cancer history. So, and usually it's first degree relatives. So I always say mom, dad, brothers, sisters, or children, if you have adult children. Now, if there's a strong family history of, let's say, breast or colorectal cancer on the maternal or mother's side, listing off all the cousins that have, you know, that just builds that case that, we may have a genetic syndrome here. And that informs testing and referrals to cancer genetics and things like that.
Yeah.
So who had what when? And then the other thing that is helpful, especially if seeing a surgeon as part of your care, but even if it's medical oncology to start with, if you have the ability to get your images on a disc and bring those with you to the visit, just in case the scans were not transferred ahead of the appointment time. That's particularly important for surgeons, because the whole reason to visit a surgeon is, can you cut this out?
Yeah.
So they need to see where it is, what structures is it located to near, you know? Yeah. So the ability, there's a lot that goes into resectability or the ability to cut out a cancer, but one of those is, where is it?
Yeah.
Where's it located? What kind of surgery would it take to cut it out? Mm-hmm. And so the films are very important for surgical visits. So bringing a disc. So if I have a patient that's going to move and transfer their care before they ever leave, I say, you need to go to so-and-so hospital center, you need to get all your films on a disc and take them with you to your first visit.
Oh, that's great advice. Yeah. And I think those are ways that individuals can steer their mental energy into productive, something helpful, productive, helpful, can empower them in the process.
Absolutely.
You know, as they come in to see you, are there a few questions that you find yourself answering often? That you feel like, for the sake of our listeners, that it would be good for them to be thinking along these lines when they come to see you? Kind of two or three high yield questions that you feel like you may even have to answer and it wasn't asked, but things where your mind immediately goes toward kind of that topic and thought.
Amazingly, one of the first things that I always make sure about is, what does this person already know? Because believe it or not, people will get referred to our clinic and they will not know that they likely have a cancer.
Yeah.
So one of the first things that I ask is, tell me what you know. What do you know about what's going on? Mm. What has been told to you? Because you don't want to jump in as if they know everything or start to. So that's one thing that is, what do you know? And then by them telling that back to you, it gives you an idea of their understanding of the current situation. In terms of questions commonly asked, everybody wants to know, can you cure me? You know, prognosis, what's it going to take? Very common question I get is, am I going to lose my hair with chemotherapy? That's a very common question. So I don't think of anything just in terms of putting that stress and anxiety into something productive ahead of time. I don't think there's any one question, but I think it's important to leave knowing what the facts are.
Yeah,
I have a mass in my colon. Or I have a mass in my, I have lymph nodes that are enlarged. And then what are you worried about? And so obviously if they're seeing a cancer doctor, we're worried this is cancer, or we're worried this is an infection, or what are the top two or three things? This could be cancer. This could be an infection. You know, what are you thinking, doc? Mm-hmm. What do you think, doc, that this is? But most of us, not to be annoying, but we've learned, until you do a biopsy or you cut it out and you see what it is, it still could be several things, right? And so you'll find that some physicians are reticent to say well, I think it's such and such, but just get an idea. I think leaving, get an idea of what do I think I'm going to get when I get the phone call after my biopsy?
Yeah.
You know, what are they thinking?
Yeah. Yeah. Great questions. Great thoughts. As someone kind of leaves that first visit, mm-hmm. and I love how your one of your passions is like, hey, I can come up with a plan. And so even if the diagnosis at that point is still part of the plan, or if it has already been made and you're developing treatment plans, when someone leaves that first visit, they're going to want to do something. They're going to want to do something to be healthier, to be better, whether you share with them that you suspect it is a cancer or it is mm-hmm. a tissue diagnosis of cancer. They want to be able to do something. They're going to look to lifestyle. They're going mm-hmm. to look to supplements. They're going to look to a lot of different places. Where are the areas where you encourage your patients to leave and take action? Nutrition, fitness, sleep, supplements, anything that is kind of broad in the cancer space that can be good to put them in better, healthier positions?
So diet is always very important, but it's not, like some might think, it's not fad type diets. It's not anything that's all or nothing is probably not necessary. Let's just put it that way. So there's myths out there on the internet that sugar feeds cancer. So I can't have anything sweet to eat or it'll go straight to my cancer. It'll make my cancer bigger. I always say cancer's a parasite. It eats whatever you're eating. If you feed it good food, it's going to have the same food you're having if you only feed yourself bad food. So nobody should only eat sugar. So sure. There is truth to not eating a lot of sugar, but none of us should eat a lot of sugar. So diet is important, but well-rounded balance. So lean meats, fish, chicken. None of us need a lot of red meat. Frankly, I think there's a recommended amount, but it's not a huge, I always ballpark it and say once or twice a week, red meat's fine, but we don't need red meat at every meal. It has some associations with, GI malignancies.
Yeah.
Vegetables, fiber, fruit, you know, healthy things. Now if a person drinks quite a bit of alcohol, recommended, you know, servings per week for a male, is it about 7 servings a week, something like that? Mm. Is that right?
Yeah.
So, you know, you certainly don't want to go over that. You might want to see if you can work on backing down from that. There's nothing other than nerves and anxiety. There's nothing beneficial about alcohol in the setting of cancer and chemotherapy and treatments for it. There's nothing medicinal about it other than anxiety.
Yeah.
So if a person can stop drinking alcohol, at least during the time of the therapies, that's smart. I always say your liver's busy. Your liver's processing other things. Let's just let it focus on one thing and not that much alcohol. So cutting back on alcohol, if the person can stop smoking, it makes them a better surgical candidate. So for example, if you have a lung tumor or something they need to cut out, you have to stop smoking before they'll take you to the operating room.
Yeah.
And so you need to go ahead and start working on cutting back on that. Exercise, people that exercise regularly do better just kind of in all things. Mm-hmm. The ability to withstand. Now nothing fanatical. So we're not talking go train for a marathon or triathlon, unless that's what you do on the usual, but regular aerobic exercise. So walking, swimming, jogging, some resistance training, those things are good. And it also is a healthy way to get natural endorphins so that you have a lift in your mood. But it also makes your body healthier. So those are some big picture things, smoking, alcohol, diet, exercise. No, you do not need, I always tell people, you do not need to go spend a lot of money on supplements. You just need to eat a good diet.
Yeah.
There's no magic supplements. Now I don't have a doctorate degree in alternative medicine and supplements. So I don't spend my days researching all of that. But just a well-rounded diet, fruits, vegetables, get some vitamin D outside in the sun. Those are all good for you.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't want people spending, or I hate it when I hear people have spent a lot of money on some supplement from so-and-so or some essential oil that their third door down neighbor told them they just had to have and it would cure them, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
if that's the case, you're going to hear about it at your visit.
Yeah.
We're going to tell you, hey, go get that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and again, I think going back to that like mental energy, it needs mm-hmm. that outlet. And some mm-hmm. people do find themselves looking to the things they can control.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because for many, I feel like this whole conversation is the wake-up call that people don't want to have.
Yeah.
You know, it's the heart attack. It's the cancer. It's the life will never be the same after this moment. Mm-hmm. And so it's really the first time many people feel that loss of control with their health.
Yeah.
And obviously there's a lot of emotion with that. But many people, and especially the people I work with, they really turn to action. Well, what can I do? Mm-hmm. You know, how can I help myself? And I always think it's important to point out, and this is true for, you know, even just more routine surgical candidates, is the healthier someone is before a diagnosis, that's obviously great. Mm-hmm. But if there are things that need to be changed, it helps the treatment to be more effective. It helps their next chapter of life mm-hmm. to be healthier. And yeah. so there's never too late a time to correct some of those wrongs.
Absolutely.
Use this wake up call as a time to get some, you know, cleanness around the diet, movement with the body, maybe decreasing some bad habits. Mm-hmm. That whether or not they led you to the cancer diagnosis or not, it'll sure make things healthier as you
absolutely.
Go through treatments.
And ability to withstand.
Yeah.
And the ability to bounce back when the treatments are done.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
As we kind of wrap up this part of the conversation, I think as someone leaves your office or leaves an oncology office with the first plan that mm-hmm. they've been given, and this is after the diagnosis has been made. So when it comes to, hey, here's how we're going to treat, I think people naturally go back to, okay, do I need a second opinion? Mm-hmm. And I always feel like that's such an appropriate thought and yeah. often, you know, very medically appropriate too, mm-hmm. but it can be done well and it can be done poorly. How do you recommend patients think about getting second opinions throughout the process of working with you? Is it something you bring up or is it something you respond to?
Sometimes this is actually a more in-depth answer than you might realize. But so first of all, it's never wrong to get a second opinion. If the doctor that you see first is offended by that, that's on that doctor.
Yeah.
It is okay to get a second opinion if you need that for your mental peace, whatever. So it's not about the doctor. Mm-hmm. It's about you getting whatever it is that you need. I do think it is possible to get too many second opinions because what you wind up doing is it can delay care. Because you don't embark on a treatment plan until you've decided upon that treatment plan. And if you're going to go get one and two and three and four second opinions, I mean, that could delay you starting therapy up to 4 to 6 weeks. Because
yeah.
every time you call a center to get an appointment, it might be 7 to 10 days to get that appointment. Then you might spend a few days there getting testing. And then it's a follow-up visit. And all of that, I mean, turnaround time of 14 days or 2 business weeks is very quick in the outpatient setting. And so yeah. if you do that multiple times, 2 weeks becomes 6 weeks, you know, because you
absolutely.
Two per
yeah.
opinion. So I actually think it's possible to get too many opinions. One expert opinion in addition to whoever you see first is very reasonable. Mm-hmm. What I encourage people when they go and get a second opinion, you have to understand, and I think most people understand this, but then don't realize that it's a misconception. It is not like television. We don't solve it in an hour, and there's not always just one way to do it. Sometimes there is. Sometimes there is. But many times, there are some gray finesse points that do this way or do it this way, and neither is overtly incorrect, right? Mm. They're both fine. Let's say it that way. So if you go get a second opinion, what you want to listen for are common truths, something you heard from the first person that you saw, something that you're hearing from the second person. And are they essentially saying the same thing? Do they agree with the diagnosis? Do they agree with the stage that you were assigned? Do they agree with the order of events of treatment? So in other words, is it going to be chemo, then a surgery, more chemo? Is it going to be surgery first? Then chemo on the back end, maybe plus minus. Is radiation going to be involved? when do we do the radiation? So you got these modalities of therapy, but the order of how they're given can change.
Yeah.
So you want to hear the thoughts on how they would sequence, at least based on the information they have at the time of the visit, how would they sequence the therapies? But what I always encourage my folks to go get second opinions, you want to listen for common truths that you're hearing, no matter whose office you're in. Those are your mainstays. Those are what we know. And then the other facets can be more of the art of medicine rather than the black and the white. So in other words, it's not wrong to go get one. It's about the patient, not the doctor. If you're going to get second opinions, I would highly recommend you go to a large center, maybe there's the National Cancer Center Network, NCCN, National Cancer Center Network. Those are large institutions all across the nation, United States, that have certain certifications. They've met certain criteria. Go to one of those. Either it's the cheapest flight, you know, or wherever, but go to a large center, a large volume center. You might be able to ask the person you see first, hey, is there a center in the US that's known for what I have? If they may or may not know, if they're a general hemonc, they may not know. If they're a research academic hemonc, they may be able to say, yes, so-and-so center publishes the most on this topic.
Yeah.
That you'd want to go something like that. So go to a bigger academic center that's doing a lot of whatever it is you have. That's the other thing, is you want to be under the care of a center, a doc, a team, where whatever it is that you have is not uncommon, even if it's uncommon. So even if you have an uncommon cancer, you want to get yourself to a team where they've done it before. And it's not, because your success rates and everything will be measurably higher if the surgeon that's doing your rare disease, fill in the blank, has done it several times before, or lots, depending on the incidence rates. So that's important. And then the other thing I was going to say is, oh, how to do it? Just do it. Don't worry. It's not about the doc. The doc shouldn't get their feelings hurt. I'm very used to people getting a second opinion. What I find interesting is sometimes patients will try to hide the fact that they're getting a second opinion.
I was just about
and
to
so
ask
you
that,
don't know that they're doing that, but you know that they're not returning your phone calls and they're not answering about wanting to schedule, and you don't know what they're doing, and it generates this work on the back end. Just be honest. If you're going to, hey, I want to fly to so-and-so and get a second opinion, I understand what you've told me, I'll shoot you a message or I'll call your office as soon as I get back. Just tell them what you're doing so that they understand why there's this pause. And I'll say, depending on your doc, you know, we practice medicine in the United States, and I practice on my patient population are adults. So they're if they're competent, I'm not going to chase them down. We've educated you. This is our assessment. This is our recommended treatment plan. They're adults and they need to follow through. And so it's helpful if you can just let that office know, hey, I'm going to spend the next 10 days getting a second opinion at center such and such, and I'll get back with you. I'll let you know what I decide when I get back. Just tell them. There's no reason to hide it. So I don't know if there's a wrong way to get a second opinion other than go into somebody's, again, these personal recommendations are good, but just be careful of who you're seeing, because you don't just want to go to that person's popular physician. You want to, if you're going to go get a second opinion, go to somebody that knows the academics of whatever it is that you have. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was going to ask about whether or not that should be disclosed, because I don't know if it's the Southern culture we live in, but many times I work with people who they'll come to me and they'll say, well, you know, I want to get a second opinion, but I don't want Dr. Spradlin to know about it. And I'm thinking, well, she'll probably find out when records are requested. and so you'd rather probably tell her face to face. But also, I have felt like patients need to see how their doctor would react to that too.
Absolutely.
Where if the doctor does take offense to it, you kind of learn a little bit about the doctor there. And that's where I go back to that bedside manner being so important, where if someone's going to have a chip on their shoulder because someone else wants a second opinion, that may be a flag of, this isn't my team. Even if the treatment plan ends up being what I'm going with, if it's someone who was offended or felt disrespected through a very open and respectful process. Mm-hmm. That's information that now you can think outside the box with. So now thanks for answering that. I think that that actually is probably one of the more common things that I run into with my members is they'll meet, I mean, really almost across the board. I think in oncology, you just want a second opinion. You want to make sure that that you get a couple of brains on the same topic.
There's a notion that you should.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's necessarily wrong. I do think it matters who you're getting the second opinion from.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're right. I think there is a lot of, oh, you got to see this person. Oh, this is the best person in town. And it's like, well, where did that information come from?
Right.
And being really thoughtful about
it. And what is that based upon? And the other thing, if you're going to get in a second opinion, depends. It depends. If you see a general, so within my hospital system, if you see a general hem-onc like me, you could go get a second opinion from within my same hospital system, but a content, somebody that focuses only on, let's say breast cancer, for example. You could go get, if you see me or one of my partners for breast cancer, Vanderbilt is where I work. We have folks that do their research in breast cancer. So you could go get a second opinion from somebody whose academic emphasis is in whatever your tissue type is. But if you're going to go, but I wouldn't see one generalist and then get a second opinion with another generalist, especially within the same system, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So if you're going to get a second opinion, level it up.
Yeah, it's a good thought.
Go get you a content expert, whether it's, you know, short plane right away or at more of an academic type team, something like that.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, thanks again, Dr. Spradlin, for joining me for this part of our conversation. I hope, you know, obviously these conversations are emotionally challenging. And I hope that the things we've talked about just help our listeners feel empowered should this become their story or the story of the family member. Thank you so much for your insights.
And you're welcome.
We'll join in the next part of our conversation next time.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to this conversation. I truly hope you found it useful. You can find out more about today's episode and discover additional resources at BrentwoodMD.com. Be sure to check out all of our other content that we've created by searching BrentwoodMD on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. If our content has provided you with value, it would mean the world to us if you subscribed to the show and left a review. This helps us ensure that more people, just like you, can find our content so that they can begin optimizing their health. To learn more about our concierge services that we provide to our members, visit BrentwoodMD.com. We'd love to meet you. This podcast was for general information only and does not constitute the practice of medicine or giving of medical advice, as no doctor-patient relationship has been formed. The content of this podcast is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Listeners should seek the advice of their own trusted medical professional.